Seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning Grace Christian Homeschoolers. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming today and welcome to the argument. You may be seated. Students are here with our program called Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. And we ask students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument, and if the students accept, they will get briefs and materials about the case and may engage in a variety of activities about the case. They then come to the court, listen to oral argument, and after our second argument at about 12:15, they will meet along with other students. They will meet with the justice of this court and discuss the procedures of the court in hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues involved. Well, we've met you. Let me introduce the rest of the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser today. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice what's his name?
Good morning.
To his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will now call our first case, which is State v. Herr, 06 AP 1239 CR. Arguing on behalf of the defendant is Donald Joseph Chuning. Mr. Chuning.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, when a criminal defendant enters into a plea agreement and waives his constitutionally protected right to a trial and all the rights that are incumbent with that, he often expects and to receive a recommendation as to a specific sentence from the representative of the state, the district attorney, the prosecutor, which presumably would be given some weight or credence with the circuit court. What a criminal defendant does not expect is that when he arrives at sentencing, that the prosecutor will advise the court, quote, "I messed up," close quote. And that is exactly what happened in this case. Mr. Hare entered no contest pleas to two felony counts with the expectation that the state would be recommending a sentence of, to use the colloquialism of the circuit courts, 10 in and 5 out. And what he implicitly got was a recommendation from the district attorney of 15 in and 10 out, resulting in a 50% increase in the amount of recommended initial confinement.
Now, Mr. Chuning, you will agree, I think, but maybe not, that the district attorney has to answer all the questions of the judge at sentencing honestly and forthrightly.
Yeah, he's, as a licensed attorney, he is subject to the rules of professional conduct, and under 20:3.3 is a duty of candor to the tribunal.
So what should the assistant district attorney have done here? What was the error of the assistant DA? I mean, yeah, you have to be up here on somebody's error, right? Well, let's pick on the DA first.
Well, the district attorney, I've conceded in the brief, I think that he did what he had to do under the circumstance.
Okay.
His error was in extending the plea agreement. And ultimately, I believe this case comes down to who bears the risk of that error in extending the plea agreement.
Well, couldn't he have done something else? Once he realizes he's got an error, he realized it before he went before the court, right?
Yeah, immediately prior to the sentencing, he informed defense counsel.
And he told the defense counsel I made a mistake, but I'm sticking by my plea agreement, right?
Correct.
Was that the correct procedure?
I think it was certainly an appropriate way to handle it. Under Robinson, he could have arguably asked the court for the state to be allowed out of the plea agreement.
Is that a better procedure?
In the eyes of Mr. Hare, no. He is not seeking plea withdrawal. He did not want to withdraw his plea. But under Robinson, in the decision written by yourself, the court specifically said mutual mistake principles can allow a state to back out of a plea agreement.
What bothers me about, I mean, even you should win, because if you should win, and if you should win on the argument that there's been a breach in the plea agreement, you are, and you've now said it again, you're just seeking another judge for another sentencing on this same plea agreement. You're not asking to withdraw the plea.
No, neither party is asking to withdraw from the plea. We're seeking the remedy of specific performance at which...
Okay. So you get a new judge, right?
Right.
And what is that judge going to do after that judge doing his or her job will read the court decision, will find out that the state made a mistake, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's that judge going to do? What's the judge going to say to the prosecuting attorney?
Well, if the judge makes the same inquiry and compels the same response.
Don't you think the judge should make the same inquiry?
Not necessarily. I mean, should he? He's entitled to. He or she is entitled to. I don't know if there's any particular responsibility to make that inquiry in this case.
It is a responsibility to know as much as you can know about the defendant before you sentence.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. But as to the particular rationale or what went on in the district attorney's mind as to why he extended a plea agreement, that's not frequently not touched upon at a sentencing hearing. The district attorney could make an argument consistent with the plea recommendation that he agreed to make.
But there's several things in the record that if you looked at the record carefully would show that there was a mistake here, right?
Oh, I think it's incontrovertible. There's the letter extending the plea offer, which is included in my appendix. There's also the statements by both counsel at the plea hearing in which they both acknowledged this is intended to be the same, a sentence recommendation consistent with what the co-actor actually received in another branch of the circuit court earlier.
What's your strongest argument?
My strongest argument is that there was an error here. The district attorney made an error in extending a plea agreement. And essentially what the Court of Appeals and the circuit court has found and what the state is arguing is that there's no breach and that the defendant, it's just tough. You have to live with it. I think the strongest argument I have is that this is a breach. It may be a necessary breach, as the state uses the term necessary in its argument, because it was compelled by questioning in the circuit court. But in all of the prior cases, there's nothing that requires us to look at why the breach occurred. The breach happened. It can be a good faith breach. It can be an inadvertent breach. But the state undermined the plea agreement. I don't think there is a bigger breach than telling the circuit court, I made a mistake. In essence, what you're telling the circuit court is, don't listen to anything I'm about to say about the sentence that I'm going to recommend, because it's premised on a mistake. And under those circumstances, I believe this court should acknowledge that that can constitute a breach and that there should be relief.
Mr. Chuning, let me ask you this. You're saying you want specific performance
Correct.
Of the plea agreement. Does that mean in some way that the judge should be bound by the plea recommendation?
No,
I'm not sure I understand what specific performance means in this context.
The specific performance does not really entail any actions or decision on the part of the circuit court. The circuit court is free to do whatever it chooses. That's established. It's not bound by the plea agreement. Specific performance is a sentencing at which the prosecution makes its sentence recommendation without simultaneously undermining the agreement.
But what if I think that's what the chief was getting at too, what if the new judge, you're assuming there's going to be a new judge, what if the new judge says, well, you know, I'm looking at what your co-defendant got here, and I've got the pre-sentence report, which makes it clear what the co-defendant got here. So I'm going to, looking at everything that's gone on here, do exactly what you folks agreed to, because there was another part of the agreement, wasn't there? The other part being that we're intending to recommend what the co-defendant got?
Yes, that was of record. If the circuit court did that without the prosecution coming in and saying we made an error, I believe that I would have no possible grounds of objection, because a breach of a plea agreement is aimed at, and it stops with, the actions of the prosecution. We don't need to consider what the circuit court did. If the circuit court relies on that as its rationale, Mr. Hare, I believe it would be without any relief at that point.
So what you're really spotlighting, as I understand it, is the mistake here was that the prosecutor admitted a mistake.
If the circuit court inferred that there was an error, I don't believe the defendant could do anything. Again, the judge is not bound by the plea agreement, not a party to the plea agreement, can make its own rationale. And certainly, as the state points out, that what a co-actor in a joint criminal activity receives is a relevant sentencing consideration under Galleon. So I think the court could consider that. The error here is the state's response, which was compelled. I mean, it's what makes this a difficult case, is that, I put no fault on the district attorney with regard to that initial admission. I do put some fault on the district attorney with regard to what he did afterwards, because he didn't do anything to really ameliorate the situation. He didn't stress an argument that focused on the 10 in and 5 out that he initially recommended. What he did was go on and point out, I can't tell the difference in which of these two co-actors, I call them co-actors, they weren't really co-defendants because they weren't charged in the same case, but which of these two co-actors was the more aggressive one, which is what the argument that the defense was making, is that my client was the passive, less violent, less confrontational, and more accommodating to the victim. It's a pretty heinous offense here. I don't make any bones about it. That the victim couldn't tell the difference, pointing out that this was joint criminal responsibility. I believe that the argument he made in that regard just telegraphed to the court, you know, I made a decision to treat these two the same, and here I'm arguing, without saying so, he didn't do it explicitly, treat them the same.
Mr. Chuning, let me ask you this. Generally, a plea agreement contemplates a meeting of the minds. And I look at the letter that's in Appendix 10 of your brief, noting that the offer reflects the same sentence received by the co-defendant on the same two counts. I look at the transcript of the plea agreement proceedings at Appendix 12 and 17, restating that this comports with the sentence that was received by the co-defendant in a different branch earlier on, also done by plea, and then asking defense counsel, the plea agreement is correctly stated. Is that right, Mr. Seymour? Yes, it was. So when I look at these questions here from the court about the plea agreement, and I look at the agreement as stated on the record, the agreement seems to contemplate a recommendation that's consistent with the sentence that was given in the other case. Now, your argument is that, well, the agreement was for 15 years, 10 in and 5 out, as opposed to 25 years, which was the actual sentence given in the other case. So I guess my question is, and it's foundational, do we have a valid plea agreement here? Because you're arguing for specific performance, and if you get specific performance, I'm not sure what the answer is. Is the answer 25 that the prosecutor should be arguing for, or 15, as you've argued here in the case?
I agree with you. Accurately stated the record, Justice Butler, with regard to what the factual premise was. And at the plea hearing, if you just read the plea transcript, there's no question that both parties, at least through their counsel, have indicated that this was consistent with what the co-defendant received in another branch. Is there a valid plea agreement? In order to back out, there would have to be mutual mistake. Mr. Hare testified at the post-conviction motion hearing that he wasn't bargaining for what Mr. Zhang got, the co-actor. He was bargaining for 10 in and 5 out. That was his bottom line. The other issue, and I addressed this in a footnote, and quite frankly, I saw this as where the state was going when I drafted the brief, and it's not where the state went, but that this was a mutual mistake, and therefore the plea agreement should be eviscerated and all the parties taken back to square one. That's not what the state is asking for. The state is asking specifically that we, or for the court to conclude there was a valid plea agreement, and we honored it.
My question, I understand what the state's arguing. My question goes to as to what the defense is arguing, because the defense is arguing there's a breach here, and but this, the defense is arguing for specific performance. I'm not sure what the answer to specific performance is. And if there's no meeting of the minds here, if we don't have a valid agreement, then you're not entitled to specific performance. You're entitled to withdrawal, as I understand it. So my question, once again, is foundational. Are you here asking for the correct relief?
I don't have any choice as to what relief I can ask for. My client has chosen the relief. So I'm asking for the relief that I'm authorized to ask for. I believe plea withdrawal clearly...
But then you don't want this court... Should the court consider this? You don't want this court to remand this for withdrawal of the plea. That is not the remedy you want.
My client has indicated he does not want plea withdrawal.
So this court could say, hey, lots of problems, could say. You don't think that the state, although it answered the questions properly and should have, that this still amounts to a violation of the plea agreement, but that the relief sought is wrong, therefore we don't give you anything. That's the danger, right? What a danger.
That is a danger. I mean, I'll be honest.
That's what you want. That's what your client wants.
That's what my client wants.
Okay.
Remedy has always been an issue that was a sticking point. It's why I made it a particular, I made a factual record in the post-conviction motion hearing on that point. The state, however, if you look at their brief at page 34, agrees with the remedy. It concludes, if you find a breach and there was an effective assistance of counsel, which is also a predicate here to get there, that it has no problem with the remedy sought. The state is not seeking plea withdrawal. I agree plea withdrawal would be an appropriate remedy. I don't believe it is an exclusive remedy in this context. I believe we could send this back to the Sheboygan County Circuit Courts, sentencing before a different branch. Who knows what happens at that hearing? A lot of things have to happen for the error to get to where it is now.
I'd like to have you sort of walk through the remedy that you are actually seeking.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, there are four judges in Sheboygan County, or five?
I believe there are five, but I...
Five, okay. You don't want this to go back to Judge Langhoff, I assume?
No.
Okay. You want it to go to Judge Stengel?
It can't.
Can't.
Because there was a substitution filed on Judge Stengel.
All right. So there are three left. There are three left then. Do you think any of those judges will have read the decision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
I hope so. I'm not asking for an unlearned judge to take this case. I believe they invariably would. But I can't control that. I think it matters as to what happens in the context of the sentencing hearing.
Well, even if the judge doesn't read it, don't you think the assistant DA will tell him?
You better not. I would say that would be, if he's going to focus in on, he can cite the fact that this has been up to the Supreme Court and back. I certainly think that would be noteworthy, but I don't think the DA, without prompting from the circuit court, in this case, should or could say, we're here because my boss or, the district attorney originally made an error in extending this plea agreement, and we've been back and forth, and we're still sticking by that same plea agreement. I think that would be a breach.
It seems to me, in all honesty, I'm not unmoved by the argument you make on the merits, but the remedy being sought is almost, forgive me, laughable. I mean, I don't see how there could possibly be anything other than the same result.
Well, I don't take offense at it being laughable. I didn't choose the remedy. Again, this is my client choosing, so this is where we just ended up procedurally. As for, I could see a circumstance that we just go round and around and around. We can't unring the bell. It's out there. I can understand that. But a lot of things have to happen. One, first of all, there has to be an admission by the state again. If the state makes the same admission, there has to be an objection. And at that point, a ruling. And the circuit court, at that point, could do what I think really should have been done in this case, which is turn to the defendant the minute that comes out at sentencing and says, well, what do you want to do? And defense counsel should, and this goes to my ineffective assistance of counsel argument, should at that point, if not rendering objection, if not recognizing that it's a breach, although I don't think there is a more obvious breach than telling the court this is an error, should at least bring to the court's attention, we need to decide how this affects my client. And there should be some sort of discussion at that point. And the circuit court can choose the remedy. The circuit court, in the context of a breach, it's a discretionary determination as to allow plea withdrawal or specific performance, i.e., sentencing before a different judge. And the circuit court at that point presumably could put an end to all this by saying, I'm not going to allow specific performance again. We're proceeding with the sentencing. If you want to withdraw your plea, go right ahead. My client has chosen not to do that to this point. But, you know, and presumably I think at some point somebody's going to, whether it be this court or if this issue were to reoccur, assuming a remand and resentencing, would put a stop to it.
But do you think that the appropriate remedy is a remand to the trial court for the trial court to determine whether there's been a breach and what the remedy for the breach is, and ask your client whether he wants to withdraw the plea if that's a remedy that the trial court's considering? Is that what you're suggesting?
It's not a preferred remedy. I think it would be an appropriate remedy. I think it's an available remedy.
That's your second choice.
Yes. Very much so.
May I ask, counsel, are you also asking that anytime there's a breach, that a judge then send the case to a different judge?
As the remedy of specific performance is set forth in Santabello, and may not be in the text of Santabello, but in subsequent decisions, entails sentencing before a different circuit, resentencing before a different circuit court. Or different
and that judge. Circuit court judge could sentence your client to the maximum?
Yep. I mean, my client has been a while, but I'm sure he's aware that is a potential risk that he faces. Because, again, the context, what the circuit court actually does is not considered when you look at a breach of a plea agreement case. The focus is on the language and the actions of the prosecution. It kind of gets to that prejudice issue. We can't go into the mind of the circuit court. The circuit court is not a party to the plea agreement. It is free to do what it chooses as long as it exercises appropriate sentencing discretion. But once there has been a breach, the defendant has been denied the benefit of the bargain, and therefore there is prejudice. So I agree that there is a risk there, as in all post-conviction matters, there's always a risk that things can get worse. With regard to ineffective assistance, the case law makes it pretty clear, although this court hasn't addressed it, and the Court of Appeals has in a number of cases, Sprang and Luconin, that when there is a breach of an agreement, defense counsel has a duty to object. That was in this court's opinion in State versus Smith. Beyond that, though, if he has a strategic reason not to object, then he must consult with his client and get permission from the client as to not to object. Because the result, if he doesn't object, is that the plea agreement has now been unilaterally renegotiated between defense counsel and the prosecution without input of the defendant. And in this case, I believe those principles control. If you find that there was a breach, then at that point, I believe you must conclude that there was also ineffective assistance of counsel.
Didn't those cases involve a situation where the prosecution rescinded the agreement is based on a mistake or based on an error?
I believe in Sprang it was just more of the argument that was made was kind of over top and inconsistent with the sentencing recommendation. In Luconin, I think the exact words of the prosecutor were, this defendant's going to be getting a tremendous break, given basically suggesting we've worked out this deal. In hindsight, it's not the best deal.
Do we have anything even remotely close to that in this case?
What's that?
Do we have anything even remotely close to that in this case?
Well, that's a mistake of judgment that the state, I mean, essentially in those cases, in most of the plea cases, even in Williams, the state is telling the court, I made a mistake of judgment here. Things have come to light when I reconsidered it. I really shouldn't have entered into this agreement. In this case, it's a mistake of fact that the prosecutor is telegraphing to the judge. Had I really known what Mr. Chong received, I would have given him a different recommendation, Judge. I think they're very...
The reason I'm asking the question is because I understand your argument if that's in fact what the prosecutor did here, but as I understood the prosecutor's response in this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, the prosecutor's response was in response to a question from the judge. The reason why there's a difference here, and it was a response to a question from the judge because the judge read the pre-sentence investigation, which said that the sentence that the co-defendant got was different than the one was being argued for here, and the judge took the plea that contemplated the same sentence. So in response, the prosecutor said, well, this is why I did what I did, but I'm standing by the recommendation, which seems to me to be a bit different from the other cases that suggest, well, he's getting a break, or, well, we're backing off the agreement, or something that akin to that. I'm not sure I see the same fact scenario in this case.
I think they're highly analogous, and I think that the fact, the words, I'm standing by my agreement, as to use this court's words in Williams, ring hollow. I mean, this is too little too late at that point. You can't tell the judge, I made a mistake, but I'm sticking by the agreement, 10 in and 5 out. You've already just taken, completely undermined the agreement. So the fact that he repeats the words of the agreement, I don't think saves the ultimate breach. In Williams, you know, the prosecutor was a probation recommendation. They kept coming back to probation, although she kept going back over to the pre-sentence report and pointing out that that was a prison recommendation and highlighting the news we've learned from the pre-sentence report and talking to the victim's family. And, you know, this court said, well, just because you can't really pay lip service to the plea agreement, which is what happened in this case. Again, lip service sounds harsh. I'm not trying to beat up on the prosecutor here because I don't envy the position that Mr. DiCecco found himself in on this morning. But at the same time, he did not, by uttering 10 and 5 out as his ultimate recommendation, that doesn't cure what happened. And moreover, I think he went above and beyond that by continuing to argue that I can't tell the difference between these two defendants, and this is a joint criminal enterprise. He's telegraphing to the court, you know, there's a reason I wanted to treat these two the same, and that's because I believe they should receive similar treatment.
You know, as I read your brief and the state's brief, it seems to me one of the essential differences in how you view the case is you view whether the prosecutor intentionally said, I made a mistake, a fact, not being prompted by the judge, and that you think that should be that the two fact situations should be treated the same. That is, whether the judge prompts it or requires it, or whether the DA just says it.
My time is up.
You may answer it. I think the state takes the position that shouldn't look at the other cases where the DA just does it on his own or her own.
Well, I believe the state and the Court of Appeals both agreed that essentially the fact that the circuit court initiated the breach, if there is a breach, and the state would contend there's not, absolves the state of the consequences of that breach. And I believe that
you
can't consider that cause. I do believe that is the fundamental distinction between the state's argument and my argument.
Even though you do not think that the prosecuting attorney erred in answering that truthfully.
I've gone around and around on that. Is there some other way he could have answered that would be consistent with his ethical obligations? I mean, initially, I thought, you know what, you're an advocate, get in there, argue for 10 in and 5 out, find some way. But ultimately, when you're asked a point-blank question, an attorney has to honor the court honestly, so I don't fault him for that, no.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Wellman.
Thank you. The state this morning asked this court to hold that the prosecutor did not commit a material and substantial breach of the plea agreement in this case because he did no more than he was ethically bound to do. He truthfully answered the sentencing court's direct, legitimate question, why is your recommended sentence for Mr. Hurd less than that received by his co-actor or co-defendant, Mr. Zhang? He made the sentencing recommendation, and his sentencing arguments were supportive of the recommended sentence. In our view, that cannot be a material and substantial breach. He didn't do or say anything wrong at the sentencing hearing. He did make a mistake, which he owns up to and is, you know, absolutely agrees. He made the mistake. He looked at his file. He had apparently written it down wrong. He thought Mr. Zhang got the 15-year sentence, and that's why he wanted to treat them the same. But once he was at the sentencing hearing, he had no choice but to ethically answer the trial court's question honestly.
Now, if the judge hadn't asked the question and he volunteered that he had made a mistake in effect, what would your answer be as to whether there's a material breach?
I don't think I would not be willing to say it would automatically be a breach, because I think each case we have to look at all of the context. And we'd have to imagine, well, you know, why did he, you know, we'd have to have some facts to fill in. How did that come about and why did he say that?
Everything's the same here.
If everything is the same and he just walks in and says, I just want you to know, Your Honor, this isn't what I really intended. That may well be a breach, because the sole purpose it would serve, it appears, would be to undercut the real recommendation. Here, the purpose it serves is to answer a legitimate question. So we always, I mean, the same words in one transcript can be a breach and not in another. For example, in one situation where the crime has been reduced drastically from first-degree intentional homicide to second-degree reckless, the prosecutor might be arguing very strenuously how awful the crime was and how, you know, how unnecessary it was and how, you know, what a bad record the defendant has, because he wants the highest end sentence of that lower crime, not because he's really signaling, you know, we should never have made this deal. So you always have to look at context. I wouldn't want this court to make the assumption, because I think that's not the way the case law is developed. We always look at context. I hope we don't, but if in a few months from now this court or we are faced with a situation where the prosecutor just made the same kind of mistake and volunteers it to the court, that will have to be assessed on its own facts.
Let's take those facts, as the Chief said. Everything is the same except omit, and I'm looking at the transcript, page 21 of the transcript, lines 16 to 18. That's the question of the court. And why is the recommendation, or why is the plea agreement recommendation on behalf of the state less than the sentence imposed in the companion case? Let's say everything is the same. I suppose you have to delete the final sentence of the answer on page 22, lines 20 to 22. But everything is the same. Is that a material and substantial breach? So you have all of the facts. You're deleting the judge's question, and you're deleting the end of the response that says on page 22, lines 20 to 22, if the court asked me this question, I would truthfully answer as to why it was less than the co-defendant, and that's why. So everything else is the same. You got all the facts. Is that and you've got the transcript. Is that a material and substantial breach?
So we're just assuming that he just comes in and starts saying, you know, my notes reflect that.
No, this is what you should assume exactly what is on the printed page verbatim, and it's this. After he says, the state will be recommending a total prison sentence, and that paragraph, which appears on page 21, he then follows that with, I will tell you, Judge, because my notes from the companion case indicated that I did ask for 25 years total, etc. That's what I'm asking you to assume. Verbatim.
I think it would be difficult to justify why the prosecutor would do that in support of the recommended sentence.
Would that be a material and substantial
breach? It could be.
You have all the facts. You have the actual words. Is it a material and substantial breach under your analysis?
I think we have to look, as I said, at what purpose it serves in the context of the actual hearing. And in that context, it may serve no purpose except to undercut the recommendation.
Let me follow up with this questioning regarding purpose. There is an argument that a breach is a breach, There can be an argument that a substantial and material breach is a substantial and material breach is a substantial and material breach. What kind of breach are we talking about? Does it make a difference if it's a good faith breach? What if it's a substantial and material but good faith?
It's not the good faith that makes it a substantial and material or not one. It's whether it has the effect of undermining the plea agreement, and it serves that purpose. There's no other justification for it. For example, the prosecutor could bring in negative facts that came about after the plea recommendation was made. If the purpose of doing that is to rebut a defense counsel's untrue argument that, you know, since this crime, he's really learned his lesson, he hasn't done anything wrong, he's very remorseful, blah, blah, blah. The prosecutor could say, you know, he's been disciplined 3 times in the jail, he's been calling the victims home against the court's order. Now, if he just threw those in for no reason to make the defendant look bad and make it look like, you know, we wish we'd recommended something greater, and that's what the trial judge or the appellate judge has to determine from the facts.
I have no problem when there's devious intent, you know, when they really try to undermine. But what I'm focusing on is what happens when there is good faith. The purpose isn't to undermine. The purpose isn't to be devious. So can you have a good faith purpose? The effect may undermine, and it constitutes a material and substantial breach. It seems to me you're saying that the purposes it serves makes a big difference, and I'm wondering if it does.
Well, I think it does in this situation, because the purpose it serves is the purpose of being the ethical duty to be honest with the tribunal and answer the question in something the tribunal is allowed to know.
Okay, that's the purpose. That's good faith. You know, that's sainthood. You know, I mean, it's good. It's being ethical. It's being candor to the tribunal. But can't you have a good faith purpose that the effect undermines such that it's a substantial and material breach? No matter how...
You could. You certainly could. And, I mean, you don't have to have bad faith to be a breach.
No. So what? You can have good faith.
I'm sorry.
You can have good faith intentions, good faith purpose. But if it's good faith and the effect is that it undermines the plea agreement, it can constitute a material and substantial breach, even if it was good intended.
It could in some situations, certainly.
So why isn't this case that situation?
Because in this case, it's more than good faith. It's that there was nothing wrong in what the prosecutor said. It's not the good his subjective good faith. It's that the trial court had a right to ask the question. Prosecutor had a duty to answer it. And when we talk of a breach, it's because something wrong was said, not necessarily with bad intent, but the prosecutor's argument went too far in signaling we didn't really wish we hadn't made this agreement, or he's not the guy we thought he was. And I think the heart of it is, as you pointed out in my opponent's argument, if we remand this for resentencing, as we would in other plea breach cases, we would be telling the prosecutor, go back before a new judge, do your sentencing hearing, and don't say those things that we have told you you shouldn't have said. In this case, we can't effectively do that because, unless we tell the trial court, don't read the record, don't read the Court of Appeals decision, don't read our decision, pre-sentence, don't report on what the co-defendant got, because that might cause the court to ask the legitimate question, how come you're asking less for him? Do this all in a cocoon. And that is so inimical to our system of a fair sentencing, and where the information is something the court should have. I just think I can't fathom that would be an appropriate route to go. That's really the only thing that would give the defendant the relief that he's asking for. And the reason the relief doesn't work is because it's not running to the right place. A remedy should run to the wrong. The wrong here was he made a mistake when he made the offer. Now, if at the time when he had first told defense counsel that, and defense counsel before sentencing had talked to the client and they had decided, we don't want to go on with this because we think we're going to get creamed by the judge, that might be a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea before sentencing. I'm not saying it would be a breach then. It doesn't change and become a breach at one point and not a breach at another. But it might be a fair and just reason for withdrawing from the plea, because that's all you have to have pre-sentencing. But he doesn't want that, and the state doesn't want a plea withdrawal at this point either. We're not coming in and saying, well, if we did something wrong, we want plea withdrawal instead, because we don't want to put the victim through that at this point, many, many years after trial. We don't think that serves anyone's purpose. The unhappy fact is that sometimes mistakes get made. We hope not often. We hope they won't be repeated. But there just isn't always a perfect answer for that in the system. And in this case, to say he doesn't get a remedy because it wasn't a breach, because he had to give an honest answer to a legitimate question, doesn't mean that we don't respect the defendant's due process rights. It just means that there is no remedy in resentencing for this individual. And it's certainly far too late for him to now want to withdraw his plea, and of course he's not asking for that even at this point.
Well, one of the things that I question is this, and the Attorney General's office does educational programs for law enforcement, does educational programs for district attorneys. What should a district attorney do when, to use Justice Bradley's expression, in good faith, he enters into a plea agreement with a defendant and then finds out that it's not a mistake of judgment as such, but as you said, a real mistake of fact? He thinks he's giving the same agreement as the co-defendant got in terms of ultimate sentencing, and he finds out wrong. So what you have is, Justice Butler said, a potential of no meeting of the minds to the extent you use contract principles. What should, in an ideal world, and of course we're several months and years and in context away from just going into sentencing, what would you tell district attorneys to do, regardless of whether the state wins the case? What should an assistant DA or DA do when there's an error in the facts and that the plea agreement, therefore, has error, and that if the trial court finds it, the DA is going to have to tell the truth, which I totally agree with, and our cases say that.
I don't think it was necessarily wrong for the prosecutor to do it the way he did, because then he's giving the most power, if you will, or the most choice-making to defendant and defense counsel to decide what to do with it next. He might also, as an alternative, we might suggest, well, you know, you could have gone to the judge, you and defense counsel, open the court with saying, Your Honor, we need to inform you of something before we start the sentencing hearing. I've discovered I made this mistake.
On the record.
And then have the court give defense counsel and defendant time to talk about it, come back on the record and say, now that you've talked, do you understand your options? Are you choosing this, that, or the other? And, you know, I'd certainly be happier because I have a record, and I always like it better when I have a full record. But I hesitate to suggest that this court should suggest that this for future. I mean, I think certainly if we can think of something that really would work better and can suggest that, if this happens in the future, everyone, here's what we think you should do, and this is better, I'm all for that. The downsides of that are, I think, some defense counsel would say, you know, I'd rather take my chances, it just might not come up, than have the court educated early.
Isn't that exactly what defense counsel was betting on?
I think he was hoping that.
He was hoping the judge wouldn't ask the question. If he doesn't ask the question, he gets a plea deal that he knows was mistakenly entered into, but it benefits his client.
Right. I also think, you know, there's always some risk, and I know we've seen this in some of the cases where courts do colloquies with the defendants at trial about waiving your right to testify. There is always some concern about whether, certainly unintentionally and not with any meaning to do that, the court is somehow in questioning the defendant, doing a colloquy, signaling him how the court thinks he should do, Or will the defendant think, well, the court's talking to me now, that must mean he thinks my attorney's not any good. I mean, we just don't want to run those risks. So it's not a perfect answer either. And, you know, this court may decide that that's better and therefore, you know, would recommend it. I guess I'm still on the fence. I'm not willing to say that's necessarily better than what happened here.
You know, counsel, I'm trying to think of, I bet more often than not, when I ordered a PSI in a sentencing at the trial court level, there was information or other convictions or victim statements or something that would come up in there that counsel probably didn't know about. They weren't trying to pull the wool over my eyes. They were just, they didn't know. And you have that information, and you're supposed to have the most information you can so that you can sentence someone accordingly. Why isn't that what happened here? The judge had the relevant, truthful information when the judge exercised the judge's discretion to sentence this particular defendant.
I think it did happen here. I mean, I think that was perfectly legitimate for the court to ask and for the prosecutor to answer.
I mean, these kinds of things happen all the time. PSIs have all sorts of information, other convictions and facts relating to convictions and statements of other individuals and mental health records and alcohol issues and all sorts of things that come up that may militate for or against a particular plea agreement that's set before the court.
Right, and we deal with that, of course, by making sure that the defendant and his counsel have a chance to go through the pre-sentence beforehand and to put any corrections or, remarks in response to that during their sentencing remarks. I'm assuming that, for example, it's not just the information about what the co-defendant got, but why the prosecutor's recommendation was less.
That's the point.
That's the heart. If that little piece, had somehow come in from some other means, it's hard to imagine how, but just suppose it did, that the pre-sentence author knew it and put it in the pre-sentence, then I assume opposing counsel wouldn't be contending that's a breach. He might be some other legal theory that he would pursue.
But back to Justice Bradley's question when she said, look at the transcript. So if the judge found this all out from all the other information in the record, which there was a lot here, and then the judge said, okay, I've heard the state, and you've recommended 10 and 5, and I've heard the defendant, I'm going to give you 15 and 5. I think those are not the right numbers, but if they're not, I intend to make whatever the, quote, co-defendant got. I'm going to give you 15-5 because that's what an equal co-defendant got. I think that's fair. I think you deserve it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This case wouldn't be here.
Right, I agree.
It's only here because in response to a question, the state's attorney answered honestly and truthfully, which the counsel had to do.
Right.
And that was contrary to, I'm not going to say breach because that's you're going to object to that, contrary to what one would expect prosecuting attorney to say when dealing with a plea agreement.
And I do take issue with defense counsel on whether in the rest of his remarks the prosecutor...
That's another question I was going to ask you. You disagree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he definitely argued in support of his recommended sentence. He didn't just mouth the words, oh, and by the way, we still stand by our recommendation. He pointed out to the court the defendant's background, which was some prior offenses, but no prior violence, no prior threats of violence. That was a positive for the defendant. He also, when he was talking about, you know, we can't tell which guy was the, quote, nice guy and which was the bad guy who held the gun on him and was threatening, he did that in the context of recognizing and again, very honestly telling the court, look, up until now, the victim has told us they were both wearing something over their faces. I'd never seen either of them before. They're total strangers. I don't know which guy was which. I don't know which guy held the gun on me and which guy tried to kind of calm things down and make sure nothing bad... really bad happened. All of a sudden, and then at the pre-sentence, he apparently told the pre-sentence author, Mr. Herr was the bad guy. He was the mean one. He was the one holding the gun on me. The prosecutor said, Your Honor, I don't know what he's basing that on. What he's told us up till now is he couldn't tell. So he's basically saying, you know, I can't support, give you anything in support of that. He's also saying, Mr. Herr is now telling you he's not the aggressive one. I don't have any facts to rebut that. All he said then was, oops, I have it tabbed and then I untabbed it. Nevertheless, they did this, they both did this together, I believe were his words. So he didn't make the argument, therefore you should treat them the same, therefore they're equally culpable. Now, to be clear, certainly we could have, in another case, we could have a fact situation where the prosecutor honestly answered the question, admitted his mistake, but then went on to make the most of that and use that as a springboard to argue, really, you should give this guy the 25 because he's just as bad as the other guy and here's all these reasons why. In that case, we might well have a breach, but it would be because, not because of the honest answer, but because of the embellishment that he added to it. In that case, it might make some sense to remand it for resentencing because what we'd be telling the prosecutor is, if the court asked you that again, if the new court asked you that, you answer the question and then you don't add all that embellishment. So I'm not saying it can never be a breach just because it included an honest answer. We're saying an honest answer where he didn't do anything else that was undercutting the agreement is not a breach.
Could I ask you, this is in your brief to some extent, but when the court writes this opinion and describes what happened here, what is the label that you think the court should put on what the prosecutor did?
At sentencing.
I mean, is there a breach? Are there adjectives in front of the breach? I mean, what... Are you going to say it wasn't a breach?
We are saying it wasn't a breach. We are saying that when the prosecutor gives an honest answer to a legitimate question that the trial court is entitled to ask, that is not a material and substantial breach. We're also saying that in this case, he gave the recommendation he promised to give. He made arguments in support of it. He didn't undercut the agreement, and the truthful statement, therefore, did not deprive the defendant of the benefit of his bargain. So we're not saying it was a little breach, or it was a white lie breach, or it was, you know, an unintended breach. We're saying it was not a breach.
Now, let's say there are two defendants. And one defendant, they're tried separately. And one defendant gets 15 years actual prison time and 10 years. Then the next defendant comes along. You can promise almost that defendant almost anything in terms of a sentence and then say, oh, I made a mistake later on. If there's no consequence to the original mistake, and then you just answer honestly when the court asks, how come the disparity here? It seems to me there has to be some sort of consequence or we put our seal of approval on mistakes.
I don't agree that there is... I understand your concern. I don't think this will mean that prosecutors will therefore go out and be deliberately careless. I mean, what you're saying... I mean, if they did that and it really wasn't an honest mistake, then we've got another problem altogether with what that prosecutor did. I don't think this will cause prosecutors to be more mistake-prone or more careless just because they think there's no remedy. Because if this had come up early, if the defendant, when he first learned of it, had said, I want to withdraw my plea before sentencing, as I say, that might be a fair and just reason. It might also have ramifications of making other counsel, defense counsel, less willing to deal with a prosecutor or more leery of a prosecutor, it could have a damaging effect on his relationship. But I think the key point here is just because there's no direct punishment or remedy to the prosecutor, they'll make, you know, make them not do that again, doesn't mean that we're giving our seal of approval. For example, in the Banger type of case, where the trial court makes an error taking the plea, he forgets to tell the defendant all of the elements, or he forgets to tell him of one of the constitutional rights. I mean, that's wrong. We don't want trial courts to do that anymore. We don't want to tell them we approve of that. Nonetheless, the defendant doesn't get relief unless, in fact, he did not know that. So you have to have, you know, it's not just a mistake. We just don't give. I'm just saying that there is no remedy that's effective in resentencing in this case, and there is no breach. It's not saying that we don't care that the prosecutor made a mistake or we're giving our stamp of approval on it.
Ms. Wellman, let me ask you this. We've been focusing on the prosecutor's mistake here in this case, and I want to refer to Appendix 16 of the defendant's brief, page 6 of the plea transcript. And it was in response to the question about whether or not there should be a pre-sentence investigation. And as I see defense counsel's response in lines 14 through 18, I think the reason we didn't, and that is request a pre-sentence investigation in a sense, was because we have the co-defendant who received the same sentence. We're kind of basing things on that, but I understand if the court would want to have one. So what I see here, and I'm asking the question, is that there was a mistake by the prosecution here, but there also appears to be a mistake by the defense. And so if you've got a mistake on the part of both parties, my question is who has the responsibility, or does anyone have the responsibility, to advise the court of the mistake?
I do think that, I mean, obviously the defense counsel also assumed the prosecutor was right and he didn't go look for himself.
Right.
So to the extent that's a mistake, it was a mistake. I don't know if either party has a duty to inform the court if they're both willing to go ahead with the sentencing and the defendant is willing to go ahead with the sentencing. I don't think it's the same as making an agreement not to divulge information to the court if asked, which this court has clearly said, you know, you can't make agreements to hide information from the trial court. On the other hand, I don't think it would have been inappropriate at all for either of them to go to the court on the open record with the other counsel and defendant present and say, look, we have a problem here. We've discovered this mistake. And that may well, you know, have just brought everything out to the open, and then we'd have either a waiver on record or a withdrawal on the record or whatever would have happened. As I say, there's some downside to that, too, because some defense counsel would prefer to not do that, and some courts would prefer not to have to get involved in, you know, appear to be involved in a discussion between the defendant and defense counsel.
Counsel, this follows up Justice Prosser's question in my thinking. One way of looking at this case is that, in essence, you have the state argue, as part of the plea agreement, 10 years and 5. And the defense was free to argue what it wanted. Now, if you come in as a DA and say, that was my agreement, Judge, but I made a mistake, I think that undercuts a plea agreement. I mean, I'm sitting here as a judge, and you come to me and you say, Judge, this is my recommendation. This is my recommendation. I made a mistake in that recommendation. This is my recommendation. That certainly undermines the confidence of the integrity of the agreement. I think it undercuts the agreement, and I think in a big way. But my concern is, and so I think it's a breach. You talk about inadvertently embellishing, as opposed to intentionally embellishing. Earlier in your statements, you're talking about embellishment, but they inadvertently embellish, but it undercut. Well, does it make a difference if they inadvertently embellish or intentionally embellish? Isn't the real focus of the analysis, did it undercut in terms of determining whether or not there is a breach? Did it undercut the integrity of the plea agreement? And so I'm having problems with that.
And I can see your problem with it. I guess then we're left, even if you say it's a breach, then we're left, well, what do we do with it that's effective
that's
at
right.
this point?
That's
and
the
that's
separate
a whole,
issue.
That's a
the
difficult
separate issue.
Issue.
So I think you've got breach. I think the real question is here, what do we do with it? But so to stand there and say there's no breach, you have to stand there and say, oh, the DA saying I made a mistake, didn't undercut the integrity, I find that problematic.
I understand that you do. We do have case law we cite in our brief where other courts have been comfortable saying, you know, we won't call it a breach. We don't think it's a breach when it's an honest answer to a legitimate question. It just is not a breach.
But that's the clicker. That's the important thing. Under the facts given to you by Justice Bradley, I didn't hear her say anything about the court asking the question.
Right. I was assuming that because she didn't, maybe you didn't mean it that way. I was assuming that you're saying even though the court asked the question, you still see it as undermining it.
I see. There is a breach.
That's what I,
but it might be, as you talked about, I don't want to put the adjective. I don't know what adjective to put. That's what Justice Prosser was asking about. I mean, it does undercut the integrity of the agreement.
It certainly has that potential. And I think then we have to look at the whole record. And again, you know, the prosecutor's arguments from there on were really geared to supporting the 15 years as opposed to the much, much lesser sentence that the defense was asking for. That's a factor, too.
It seemed to me we clarified earlier in your argument that if everything were the same in this case, except for the fact that the judge did not ask the question and the state volunteered that he had made a mistake, the state would say, on the facts of this case, that that was a material breach.
I think so, with nothing else to make it clear that he was doing that for some other reason, like to correct a mistake.
And the only difference between that case and this one is he answered the judge's question honestly, which he had to do.
Right.
And that, to you, to the state, says no breach.
Right. Okay. Because he didn't say anything he shouldn't have said, which is, in essence, what a breach is. And just one reminder, you know, you won't get to any of this unless you go through the layers of ineffective assistance of counsel. I mean, any remedy, if you... and we do brief that issue in our brief, too. So,
thank you, counsel. Mr. Chuning?
I want to follow up on Justice Prosser's question regarding, you know, we have a mistake here and we don't want to put our stamp of approval on a mistake. I think that kind of cuts to the quick as to the issue. There is a mistake. It was the state's mistake, or arguably both parties' mistakes, we contend. And I dropped a footnote on mutual mistake because it wasn't the thrust of the state's argument. But, I mean, I saw that kind of as a potential problem for me. Who bears the risk of that mistake? And that's why a lot of my case law in the brief has said it is about assumption of risk. Any other context where you have such disparity in bargaining powers, where a party essentially would profit from its own mistake in a contract situation. I can't think of an insurance company versus an insured. Take any case where you have an individual versus a large entity that has an extraordinary leverage of bargaining power, and I assert there's no greater bargaining power than that the state of Wisconsin has in incarcerating you and taking away your liberty. I can't imagine in another context, in a civil context, the party with the greater bargaining power being allowed to benefit from its own mistake.
Counselor, but wasn't your client trying to benefit from the prosecutor's mistake? He knew before sentencing that there was a problem, and the prosecutor was very straight with him, saying, if the court asks me, I have to answer honestly.
I think
you could have stopped right there. There could have been no sentencing. You could have asked for an adjournment. None of those things happened. Why? Because your client hoped he would sneak by on a mistake, right? So there was some risk assumption right there, wasn't there?
I think there might have been some risk assumption by defense counsel. I think the record is pretty clear, though, that Mr. Hare didn't understand that he had any options or that he necessarily cared what Mr. Song had.
Well, his option at that point in time would have been to ask for an adjournment and then to ask to withdraw his plea because it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, right? But he doesn't want to go there.
That is an option. That was an option.
Right.
Correct.
Okay.
I believe another option under the case law would have been to object and to say, Your Honor, with all due respect, your question, there's been a breach of the plea agreement, and we'd like a resentencing.
Well, Mr. Chuning, let me ask you this, because I know that you've stood on your client's request for resentencing.
But even absent a decision from this court, let's say that this court, the argument is just made at the circuit court level, and let's say the circuit court agrees and says, okay, we'll give you a different judge and you can have resentencing. Unless a circuit judge fails to read the transcript of the plea proceeding and fails to read the pre-sentence investigation, any circuit judge is going to have exactly the same question of the parties when the case comes in for sentencing. Okay, the agreement contemplates the same sentence. We don't have the same sentence being recommended here. Why not? And that's part of the problem that I'm having, is that even if we don't have an instruction from this court, even if it never came here, you're going to have the same issue for any judge unless the judge simply just doesn't read the transcript of the pre-sentence.
Right. Your question goes to remedy. I mean, exactly. I think. I mean, your questionings throughout have gone to remedy. And I see that as clearly plea withdrawal is an appropriate remedy. It may be the preferred remedy in this context. I mean, I don't think you should take specific performance off the table because we don't know what would happen at a resentencing before a different judge.
But that's not my question. I understand that you're not arguing for plea withdrawal, that you've made that perfectly clear. But in terms of specific performance, the same question is going to be before any sentencing judge, irrespective of whether it came here or not, unless the judge simply did not review the materials. That's the part of the problem that I'm having here, is because if you look at the plea transcript, it contemplates the same sentence. If you look at the pre-sentence, you see the same sentence is not being recommended. So that's going to be the first question out of any judge's mouth if they read the stuff. I mean, that's the part of the problem that I'm having.
I agree, it's an issue. And I don't necessarily think that all, I mean, I'm not a judge, I don't know what a sentencing judge has been in that position, that it's always going to come up. I think plenty of cases where you have co-actors, where I've been in sentencings for what the other guy got, really never came into play at all. And then I've had judges, a few that I can think of, who that's their guiding principle. You know, we're going to have equal treatment of similarly situated defendants. So I think I don't think you can assume that in every case that it's going to come up.
In fact, counsel, we want judges to ask questions and to reach a determination on the merits of each individual case, considering the gravity of the offense, the character of the offender, the need to protect the public, and Galien factors, right? So judges oftentimes have their CCAP computer right there. They'll look up someone's name. They'll see there's a pending charge. There might be something brand new that comes up. They ask the question. All those things can impact how someone comes out on a plea agreement or something that's being forwarded to the court. That is analogous with this situation. If a judge were to look on the computer and say, you know, I see a conviction here, but no one's referencing that, you know, explain to me why not.
First of all, defense counsel doesn't want the judge to do that, but clearly the system of justice does. But the bottom line is what happens at that point? And I've been in plenty, usually in misdemeanor pleas, where you have a plea and a sentencing back-to-back. Something comes up in the sentencing argument, and you'll have a judge frequently turn to the defendant and say, knowing what you just heard, do you still want to go forward today? And I think that ultimately, that it's, you know, I try not to put the onus on the circuit court judge here, but at some point, there was something incumbent upon the circuit court judge to say, whoa, let's put the brakes on, because there appears to be a big misunderstanding that has just come to light on the morning of sentencing. Right. Mr. Defendant, what would you like to do?
Right. And withdraw your plea or go forward. What do you want to do?
Right.
And he doesn't want to withdraw his plea.
That's what he said at the post-conviction motion hearing. That's been his position, correct?
He just wants another chance at sentencing.
Yes.
What did the state do in that example?
What would the state do?
Yeah, what did the state do in the example where the judge finds that there's been a subsequent arrest or conviction? Does the state say, I made a mistake, I found out after I did the plea agreement that he's got a lot of convictions, and not only on the Wisconsin CCAP, but I checked Illinois and Minnesota afterwards. He's got a million of them, Judge. You just don't have them on your computer, and I made a mistake.
I don't think the state can do that.
Is that what they did here?
No, because the judge asked.
Okay.
Again, that's the key.
Well, the judge asked there, too. Judge finds it on CCAP and says, How can I take this plea agreement when you got all these other arrests and
convictions? Okay, where the judge asked, and there's some federal cases that are cited by the state, where the judge did ask that, knowing, you know, knowing what you, right. what I just told you about how many times this person failed to show up for pretrial services, would you have still made the same deal? And the federal courts have said, you know, no, that's not a breach. I disagree. I think at that point, I really think the judge might be crossing the line there, too, into really entering into some sort of the, we're getting into the thought process of, what is the defense, the prosecution's rationale for underlying the plea agreement? I think that's really a closer call.
But that's the nub of this case is the judge asked the prosecutor, and the prosecutor responded truthfully. Isn't that what makes this case different than a lot of cases?
It makes this case review worthy. I mean, I think it doesn't get It's a clear breach. You would just be error correcting if the district attorney had just come into court and blurted this out. I think that has to be a breach. The reason we're here is because it was at the judge's questioning, and the duty of candor and the constitutional right to enforcement of the plea agreement are butting heads.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I want to thank both Mr. Tuning and Ms. Wellman for their excellent arguments today on a issue that the court has had previously, namely plea agreements, breach, and the obligations of counsel and the circuit court. That concludes our hearing in 06AP 1239 CR, State versus Herr. We'll take a few moments in recess so those students who wish to leave may do so, because we are expecting another class. We are in recess.